So tonight we continue with the series of talks that we're doing on my newest book, The Three Principles of Oneness, how embodying the cosmic perspective can liberate your life. So tonight we begin to actually talk about the three principles of oneness. And tonight's quote is very short. It's by the great teacher Thich Nhat Hanh. One included all, and all were included in one. Short, subtle, and sweet. So tonight we're going to explore the first principle of oneness. Now, before I go into that and talk about that, I do want to remind everyone of why we're doing all of this. What's the purpose? What's the point? And so I'm going to try to give you a nutshell version that makes it easy for you to understand and easy to share with others. The basic modern theory of Buddhism and the way that we shared in the Dragonfly Sangha, which is based upon the ancient experience, is that all human beings have evolved into self-consciousness. And when they evolved into self-consciousness, it brought with it a great separation anxiety. And this existential anxiety would mark, some would say scar, the life of humanity. And this sense of separation, this idea that we don't belong, that somehow we are aliens here, this sense of separation, according to our theory, is the source of all suffering. Furthermore, this sense of separation is understood to be a delusion. That this separation simply does not really exist. And if we want to experience freedom from that suffering, then we must awaken to the oneness of all life. When the Buddha Shakyamuni, as legend has it, awakened beneath the Bodhi tree nearly 3 millennia ago, he experienced this great sense of oneness. And then he set out to try to teach how others could have that same liberating experience for themselves. And in doing so, he observed the universe. And it was his observation of the nature of things that led him to his great awakening, his satori. And out of this great awakening came 3 concepts. We call them 3 principles. And they became known as the 3 principles of oneness. They've had other names like the marks of existence or the seals of the universe. But I like principles. Because principles, ideally, always lead to practice. And practice leads to a process, which gives both purpose, and quite honestly, is very, very pleasing as a sentient being. So it was the understanding that we could learn from the universe. We could yield metaphors and understandings about the nature of the universe. And from this, we could learn to be in harmony with things. Because ultimately, that's the goal of our dharmic life, is to live with balance. So these holy mysteries, and I call them holy mysteries, the holy mysteries of the three principles, is because holy or holiness comes from the same root of our word to be whole. It means to connect, to be one. And they are mysteries because often how they first appear from a self-conscious state, and then how they appear from an awakened universal consciousness, seems very different. Now the subtitle of this talk, for the first principle of oneness, is suffering as a clue to the meaning of the universe. Now I must confess that I took that line from one of my old favorite writers and theologians, C.S. Lewis. And Jack Lewis, in his book, Mere Christianity, presents the first chapter where he entitles it, Suffering as a Clue to the Meaning of the Universe. So I have to admit I took that from Jack. So what do we mean by that? What do we mean by suffering as a clue to the meaning of the universe? So suffering doesn't provide everything that we need to know about the universe, but it does provide us a clue to the meaning of the universe. So keep that in mind as we go forward. This is a clue to the mystery. And we are all existential detectives. Now, when you present these principles, there's two things that are required. The first is that all human beings have an existential need. So whether they're aware of that or not, or whether they would put it into that language, that lingo, they all have an existential need. So what does the word existential mean? It means that we exist. We exist, and then we try to understand what our existence means. And so the existential meaning of the principles will feed the hunger of that need. Likewise, there's an essential need that all human beings need. And this need comes from how we interact and perceive the world and how we interpret that perception. And so if the existential is separate from the essential, then we live bifurcated and a kind of bipolar existence. To be whole, humans need both. Highly evolved sentient beings need both. And so my presentation of the three principles hopefully provides both, both the hunger for the existential and the great thirst for the essential. The existential means that we must assume responsibility without ultimate certainty. And so I think of this as why things matter, the place of the spirit some might say faith. Because when we assume responsibility without having any ultimate certainty, then we must make an existential choice about how we're going to live our life. And if we don't make that choice, then the conditionings from without and within shape that for us. And we are no more than slaves carrying out the directions of a blind master. So the first calling to the existential is that we must awaken. And then we must have the courage to choose to live. To live nobly, in spite of, or in the face of, ultimate uncertainty. And you could say that the call of the Buddha, the call of the Buddhas, the call of the awakened ones, is to live nobly in the midst of chaos, to create where there is destruction. And that is why, in some present teachings of the Dharma, they are called the Noble Truths. It is a call to live nobly in the face, in the midst of chaos, and to be creative. When we choose to live nobly, if we even sort of summarize it as life seems to be filled with suffering, but I choose to live nobly, that's an existential choice. And that is a faith that does not rely on certainty. It is a way of life and a way of being that is noble. And we enter it from the place of great doubt, from the place of not knowing. We are here, and from the place of great doubt or great knowing, we offer great faith. Great faith in our own ability to awaken and our own choice to live nobly and to be creative rather than destructive. Now the essential is where we bear witness. And that bearing witness comes in the form of asking great questions. What is the universe? What is it about? What can I learn from the universe? And so in this process of bearing witness and asking these questions, this is the place of science. This is the place where we want to know. We have the humility to understand we do not know. But we want to enter in and bear witness to what we can know. And so this is the place of the essential, how things work. And as I said before, if the essential and the existential are not one, we live in a strange bipolar existence that is filled with suffering. So these two must be one. Both within and without. The essential is the set of characteristics that things seem to be or things seem to produce. and the discovery and understanding and expression of this is how things work, science. So the existential is the place of spirit, and the essential is the place of science, knowledge. And again, two become one. So what is the first principle of oneness? The first principle of oneness says that through the eyes of separation, we honestly experience life as filled with suffering. And anyone that's honest knows this is so. And it is from this basis that we can begin to explore the existential. So that first part of the principle, that when we see things through the eyes of separation, life seems filled with suffering. This is the entry point of the existential. And out of that existential place, it can cause us to do and be certain things. So for example, we can develop an ethic of interdependence. In other words, in many cases, people feel that in order to have an ethic, whether personally or socially, that there must be some force that has created it beforehand. So you end up often with the idea that some force, some power has created this ethic, or on the other side of this, you have nihilism, where there is no meaning. And between these two poles, in the middle way, comes forth with the understanding and the experience of the oneness of all life. And this experience of the oneness of all life, of the interdependent nature of being, allows us to develop an ethos or an ethic that is based simply on that. And it's as simple as this. I know that I don't want to suffer. And so therefore, it takes very little reasoning, very little understanding to know that you don't want to suffer either. And furthermore, I want to be happy. I want to have a sense of satisfaction in my life. And more than that, I want to have a sense of adventure with my life. So do you. And so the ethic of interdependence is a mirror reflection of our own experience. And so we don't need some outside force to enforce an ethos. And nor is life meaningless. We can create meaning out of our understanding of the nature of the universe, which is oneness. And it leads us not even necessarily to say that I'm going to treat you as I wish to be treated, but rather from a place of compassionate engagement, from a place of listening, I want to treat you the way you wish to be treated. Subtle, but powerful. So that's one existential creativity, an ethos of interdependence. Another one is that it allows us to look at the fragility of life, at the awareness that in a very short time, some much shorter than others, we go from birth to death. And so from this existential place, death serves as an instructive verb, a motivation that makes me appreciate this precious life, that makes me aware of the fragility of things so that I don't take them for granted. And then I am brought to not just seize the day, but to enjoy the day. For a while, you know, people were using seize the day, which is a cool line, which was made famous by Robin Williams in that great film. And while I do get that, I think actually our response is to enjoy the day, to learn to see within the day the beauty which is transient. As the great poet William Blake once said, to kiss the winged joy as it flies. And so those are just two things that come out of that first part of the first principle of oneness. The existential response, which is a call to live nobly in the face of chaos, in the face of the fragility, in the face of entropy, and to live with nobility and out of an ethic of interdependence. To appreciate this life and to never let a day go by, not a day, where we don't share love, where we don't experience beauty. There's a famous old Buddhist parable that sort of sums this up. So according to the story, there is a guy who is running away. He's in the woods, and he's running away from a tiger. And the tiger chases him to a place where there is this well. And so the fellow jumps. He looks over the well. He sees that there's a couple vines there. So he jumps into the well to avoid the tiger. And as he's holding on desperately to the vine, he looks down and he hears noises, and he realizes that at the bottom of this well is a nest of vipers. So our poor fellow can hear the hissing of the vipers laying deadly below him, and he hears the growls of the tiger as it prowls around the perimeter. And that's life. That's life, man. But our fellow, he's enlightened. And he looks over to the corner, the one side of the inside of the well, and there's a bee's nest. And he sees golden honey dripping softly. Holding on to the vine, he leans over, he sticks out his tongue and allows some of that honey to fall. And as he tastes that honey and he swallows that honey, he says to himself, this is the most wonderful honey I've ever had. There's another version of the story where it involves strawberries. And I like strawberries, but I love honey, like Pooh Bear loves honey. So I like this version better. But do you get the point? The point is that's life, you know? The tiger chases us, we jump into the well, we're holding on to the vine, below is our vipers, but there's the honey. Now some people, they would just be focusing on the tiger or the vipers, or even looking at the bee's nest and saying, oh God, now I'm gonna get stung. But not our enlightened fellow. Our enlightened fellow sees the honey, and what does he do? He tastes it. And that's, that story for me sums that aspect up. Now from the essential part, the second aspect of the three principles one is that from the eyes of separation, all life is filled with suffering, dukkha in the Sanskrit. Pali, tongues. But the second part is, from the eyes of oneness, this suffering is sealed with compassion. So that the holy mystery is, from the place of awakening, is from the eyes that can see, the scales have fallen off. Suffering causes us to see things as they are. From that place of awakening, suffering begats compassion. And this is something essential, remember? Essential, where we can observe and we can understand, we can discover. And so what we know about this interdependent web of existence, we know this from the studies of genetics, from the studies of evolution, from the studies of astrophysics. We know truly that all things are interconnected. And furthermore, when we bear witness to evolution, we see this thing emerge. We see this thing we call compassion emerge, where if you looked at it from a certain view, it really didn't need to be there. But miraculously, it's here. You see it forming and foaming and coming into realization as you come into mammals and primates and then human beings. And then human beings that will show compassion not just for those that will benefit them, but for those that will not. So how does that happen? How does that happen if it's not inherent in the process of evolution into sentience? And see, for me, that is the miracle. So when I look out at life, I look out at this whole process, which can be very painful and very mysterious. I see that it is sealed with compassion. And compassion not as an emotion of sympathy or pity, but as an action of empathy and out of an ethos of interdependence. So that the mysterious sayings of great sages like the Buddha, Shakyamuni, and Christ, that we should love those that we might even consider our enemy, that's not possible from an emotional place. But if we define compassion simply as the wish to relieve suffering within ourselves, and so if we wish to relieve it within ourselves, so does the other. And so the wish or the desire to relieve suffering is the simple motivation for our compassion, which emerges out of the wisdom of oneness. And so I can show compassion towards those that I don't like. I can show compassion towards those that at first repulse me. The great lesson is that I usually have to turn that light of compassion upon myself first. That's the hardest one. And if I can do that, knowing all my secrets, all the skeletons dancing in our closets, if I can do that for myself, then I can do that for anyone. And one of the things that we've learned, not just from evolution, which shows us this miracle that occurs, that we call compassion in the universe. If you looked at it from certain angles, like I said, how'd that happen? And people sometimes will just say, well, it's just part of the selfishness. Well, that might work in some cases, but what we find is that with human beings, they'll do it even when it means their own destruction. When it doesn't seem to benefit them at all. There's something within us, something within evolution itself, which produces this miracle of compassion. And so therefore I say, yes, through the eyes of separation, it seems that everything is filled with suffering, but from the eyes of awakened oneness, everything is sealed with compassion. And one of the things we also know from science is neurology. Neurology studies have helped us to overthrow the tyranny of the idea that either we were born in sin or that we're just really these greedy, selfish bastards driven by the blind dictates of the master gene. Don't you believe it? Because what neurology has shown us is that our brain is not actually wired for that. That it's wired for connection. That it's when we experience separation, that's when the weird stuff, that's when the really bad stuff comes in. But that our brains are actually wired for connection. Our brains are wired for oneness. And it is only when we believe that we are separate that the neurosis comes out. So, the first principle of oneness, we enter from the place of great doubt and not knowing. And we give birth to a faith that is based upon the courage to live nobly in the face of chaos. And that an ethos of interdependence arises where compassion is an action, a verb. And from an essential place where we look at the very process of evolution, we look at, understand, and discover about ourselves, and we realize that all is one. And that compassion is wired into us. And so when we look at the universe, we no longer look out in fear, but we look out and we belong. And there's an exhilarating awe and joy, a joie de vivre that can only be experienced through that first principle. So remember, suffering begets compassion.